This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
We're continuing on with our conversations with members of Northwest Indiana's legislative delegation, and we have with us State Representative Ed Soliday, the Republican, who's from Porter County. And Ed, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Good to be with you.
Let's get your assessment first on how the 2019 session went.
I thought it went really well. The Speaker ran the calendar well. We had some really good legislation and an absolute minimum of acrimony. So I think it'd be a good example for Washington.
No doubt it would. It would be very surprising if things ran as well in Washington as they seem to have run in Indianapolis, to be sure. You had a number of bills that you sponsored this time around, many of which made it out of the respective chambers and gotten signed off, at least by the Senate, going on for further review. One of them just got signed up by the governor the other day. It's involving county park boards. Tell us a little bit more about House Bill 1018.
Well, 1018, there's been some issues. There are only 15 county park boards in the state. And as legend goes, Lake County was the originator of the legislation, which allowed the judges to appoint several members. And the problem with that has been, in some of the counties, is a lack of accountability. The judges make the appointments, and they rarely know what's going on with the budget and all those kinds of things. So it's the only form of government, county, city, or state, where the judges appoint people that have responsibility for management. So there had been, for the last several years, some complaints about it. So what we did was we compromised with a lot of folks. So if you've got judge-appointed county park board members, you can keep them. If you want to make it more traditional, the county council, which again is rare, passes an ordinance, and then it says who they can pick from. And they can have one of the board members appointed by any elected official that they choose. And then if you're one of the 78 counties that don't have a park board, if you want to create a county park board, then it's traditional. The commissioners will pass an ordinance and they will appoint the folks, and the bill is specific about, I think it's two from the commissioners, two from the council, and it has to be bipartisan.
Will there be any impact with this measure now being basically signed into law by the governor here in Northwest Indiana?
Well, Porter County, of course, they were one of the strongest advocates for a change. Bipartisan, the council and the commissioners have said they'll take advantage of the law and change out their park board members.
One of the other measures that I know that you sponsored and have kept a very close eye on is House Bill 1217. It's gone all the way through the House and the Senate, and I'm sure it's probably sitting on the governor's desk now for him to do a review. This is the one involving the problems that Porter County experienced in the last general election, trying to resolve the issues. As kind of a reminder, tell us what the measure's all about and how you think things stand in it becoming law.
I'm sure the governor will sign it. The Secretary of State endorsed it. We think it could be a model for the state.
No.
I was really proud of our folks here in Porter County, both Republicans and Democrats, city or county council, county commissioners, the new Democratic clerk. We sat down and we said, what will work? Where were the barriers that came up that caused the just very bad election process this year, or excuse me, last year.
Mm-hmm.
And what we came up with was a bipartisan five-member board, no nepotism. The state liked that so well, it is going to be state law. Most, for example, in Porter County, they have no nepotism ordinances, but the election board did not have that. And so now it has a no nepotism clause. It also has direct accountability. So the clerk is in charge of the election. The clerk hires the director of elections, And the deputy director is of a different party, but she hires both with the consent of the board. And then the director hires the employees, again, bipartisan. The deputy director hires the in this case, in Porter County, the minority is the Republicans, so that person will hire the Republican side. The Democrats will hire the Democrat side.
Mm-hmm.
And if something goes wrong, there's a very clear line of who's accountable. And in the past, that has not been the case. Mm-hmm. And so we, after we drafted the bill, we took a look at the Secretary of State's investigation and analysis and the independent group out of Ball State and made sure that we addressed each of the issues that they raised. It also calls for a central count of absentee ballots, which is much more efficient and much less prone to error.
Mm-hmm. Because so many people had a chance to work on this in different areas, as you mentioned here, and even going all the way up to the Secretary of State's office and having some outsiders, so to speak, with the team from Ball State University looking into this as well, too. Do you think these factors in particular made it so not only so attractive for lawmakers, your colleagues to sign on to it, but also for the state to endorse the idea that they may make it part of the election law and maybe other counties in the state will be able to follow through? Was it something that was so well written that nobody could possibly refuse it?
I think in counties, Porter County is probably close to 50-50 Republican-Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
In counties that are, for example, Hamilton County down by the Indianapolis is extremely strongly Republican.
Right.
Lake County, very, very strongly Democrat. Whether they would be willing to accept the bipartisanness of this model would be interesting. The Senate chairman of elections asked me in testimony if I thought it was a model for the state. I said it very well could be, but let's try it for a couple of years in Valpo and see how it works. And if it works in Porter County, then let's see if we'd want to make it statewide. But to those counties that are dominated by one party, we'll struggle a little with having to yield up power.
Yeah. We're talking with State Representative Ed Soliday from Valparaiso, who's one of our delegates from Northwest Indiana, so to speak, who had been at the State House for the 2019 General Assembly session, talking about the measures that he's sponsored, and many of these that he had in the hopper this time around have gotten through the process and now awaiting the governor's review of it. One of them in particular, an important one also besides the ones involving the election process, is Medicaid reimbursement for children's hospitals. House Bill 1238 is how it was filed. Tell us more about it, Ed, and how it's standing and what kind of support it had from everybody that signed off on it.
Well, it's really important to a lot of folks here in Northwest Indiana. Representative Charlie Brown for years tried to get a level one trauma center for Northwest Indiana. And I think he also worked for neonatal level four. Neonatal four is the highest level of neonatal. Level one trauma is the highest level of trauma. And generally, those kinds of care don't make money. They're pretty cost intensive.
Yeah.
The RDA did a study. And the study result was that we didn't have the population base to warrant either one. So our level one traumas and our neonatal fours go to Chicago. And the closest of those facilities is the University of Chicago. So the Speaker of the House, I, the Ways and Means Chairman, the Vice Chairman of Ways and Means, we went up and visited the University of Chicago. And these are the poorest of the poor and the neediest of the needy. These are usually when that mom is in trouble, they know right away that it needs neonatal level four, and usually the mom needs trauma one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no competition with Northwest Indiana. But we have this very arcane system here among Indiana hospitals where they pay so much into the Medicaid fund, and therefore it's like a private club. And they've convinced the FSSA that we shouldn't pay the same rates unless the hospital belongs to the club. My view is very different. The University of Chicago doesn't have to take our kids. They do. And they have an ask. They have something that we should pay for. We should pay fairly. Nobody's asking to pay Illinois rates. We just want to pay the same there that we would pay here. And most of these kids will not make it to Indianapolis. It's just that critical. If you see what happens, normally that mom gets helicoptered to the University of Chicago, and as soon as that baby is born, their baby's on life support. So nobody's trying to take business from Northwest Indiana hospitals. We just want to make sure that those Medicaid kids will always have a place to go. I mean, it's not their fault that they're born that sick. I mean, we saw kids that weighed just a little over a pound. One little girl was born without stomach muscles. Therefore, she needed a kidney transplant. They don't do those kinds of things. I don't know of any hospital other than a teaching hospital, a university hospital, that does those kinds of things. So I asked the doctor, I said, well, with all of this, is this little girl going to make it? And he says, oh, she'll make it. She'll probably go to Harvard, but she won't wear a swimming suit.
Uh-huh.
Well, that was worth doing. Unfortunately, it got over the Senate, and I was pretty disappointed in the way the FSSA clouded the issue and said, well, you know, it was a test. That's all it was. Let's find out. It's a very complicated system. What will it cost us? Let's figure out how to make the system work. Then we can talk about Cincinnati and Louisville, but let's be fair. And in the Senate, issues were brought up. Well, does Illinois pay its bills? Well, we're not Illinois. We're Indiana. We pay our bills. We pay our contractors. And we should pay for the medical care for these kids. So it was a little frustrating. But what I found is if you don't give up and you don't go away, usually you can persevere. It came back to me, and there was no hope with a dissent that I could get it out of conference committee. So we sent a joint letter to the Speaker of the House and asked for a summer study. But I think this has gone on for years. Representative Slager, who didn't get reelected, he worked on it for 5 years.
Oh, yeah.
When he was no longer there, I said to him, Hal, this isn't exactly my expertise, but I'm going to try it myself just with a test.
Yeah, we recall having the opportunity to talk with Representative Slager at the time when this all came out, and he was very, very passionate about this as well, and I'm glad that you and your colleagues were the same too. So maybe in summer study committee it'll come out, and then next session it'll come back up again with perhaps a little better luck this time, to be sure.
Yeah, we may try a different venue in the Senate. It's coming back. Whether we get a summer study committee or not, it'll be up to the Legislative Council, and mm-hmm. you need 3 votes in there. So we'll see how that goes. But in the end, there'll be legislation next year, one way or the other.
That's great. Well, Ed, a couple more bills we wanted to talk about today. We have you in our conversation. One of them is involving economic development that is a lot geared to Northwest Indiana, but probably the rest of the state. And the other is something that definitely affects everybody in Indiana. The economic development issue is trying to help out the emerging data networks. And we know that there's a data center that is under construction in Hammond, and I know it's a part of the measure that went through. Tell us more about the bill that is now up for review.
Well, quite frankly, I'm sure it's going to be signed. Usually I don't carry them unless I'm pretty certain they're going to get signed.
Yeah.
But this is really important. This bill makes us in the top 5 states competitively for these data centers. And it's not the data center itself that creates the jobs. It's all of the businesses that surround it. Loudoun County, Virginia, just exploded with their data center. And we've talked with Facebook, and we've talked with some of the ones who run the big data centers. The one in Hammond is large, but it could go, the developer there could go to 1 million square feet.
Wow.
But Facebook, normally theirs will go $750 million, sometimes $1.2 billion. And the what we did was we said that we'll give you a tax deduction for the sales tax on the equipment, and we'll give you a sales tax on the electricity, a sales tax deduction for the electricity you use in managing data. Now, not for the offices. It's sort of the same way we do with steel mills. We don't charge the steel mill sales tax for the electricity they use to make steel, but we do charge them for that that's in the offices. Two separate meters. We also gave them some property tax relief if the local community wants to grant it. And then there's some things that require accountability, which is a hobby horse I've been on for a long time.
Yep.
So if they don't produce what they say they produce, they owe us the money back.
Well, this just stands to reason, I guess. That's great news about that measure, and it's going to help not only our area but the rest of the state as more of these companies take a look at places where they can locate data centers, and they're liable to choose Indiana, maybe even what they hadn't in the past, to be sure. And, Ed, the last one I'd like to bring up is the one on water infrastructure. It's a topic we know that your colleague over in the Senate, Ed Charbonneau, has been a champion for years and years. I remember a few years ago, he and I had maybe about a 30-minute long conversation on the phone about this. And this measure probably won't bear as long of a conversation, but still pretty important, about an infrastructure assistance fund and a program. And that one has already been signed into law by the governor. Tell us more about that.
Well, Ed has done a lot of work on water. It's really his area. I've been fairly successful getting us funding for roads and that type of infrastructure. So what we needed was to just get to closure and on funding. And we needed about $2 billion, the gap between the funding we know we have, and the question was who was going to pay. So last year I did a thing that's fairly innovative. Because of railroad crossings are a problem in Indiana, we used our bonding power and just set aside enough money for debt service that we could leverage.
Mm-hmm.
So we did the same thing because funding bills are supposed to originate in the House. I did a very similar bill that the folks in Ways and Means put in $20 million a year, which leverages up to $2 billion over time, and that will be available in low-interest loans and grants through a prioritization system that we actually modeled after what we did with community crossings. And you didn't mention it. I also carried, for in the Senate, we get confused in Northwest Indiana. The author is the guy who originates the bill. The sponsor is the person who carries it in the other house.
Right.
So we were having some issues with rural broadband. So I took Senate Bill 460 and used a system of prioritization that if it works like we think, the $100 million that the governor took from the toll road increase, that $100 million, if the priority system works, should reach 95% of the unincorporated areas with cable in the state of Indiana.
That's great.
Similar process for each of those to leverage money. And the broadband side, REMCs, they're willing to take a 5 or 6% loan and match it with their money in the 95% range, and that's a deal we don't want to turn down. So That model has worked so well in community crossings that now we've used it for water and we're using it for broadband also.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. It's good to know that these things work well, and it shows that sometimes the cooperation does flow very well at the General Assembly, and you get these important issues addressed and get them changes made, and in turn will benefit everybody in Indiana as well as here in the region, to be sure. And Ed Soliday, thank you very much for spending time with us to go over these measures that you had to, not only the ones you sponsored, but you supported as well in the General Assembly this session. And we hope the best for the issue involving Medicaid with the children's hospitals, and they can get this resolved, and then hopefully you come back, if not in study committee, and then back in before another session of the General Assembly next year, to be sure. And thank you for spending time with us to go through all this today.
Terrific. Good to be with you.
It's good to be with you, too. We've been talking with State Representative Ed Soliday. He's a Republican. He is a part of the majority at the General Assembly, and he represents voters in Porter County. The University of Notre Dame has installed a system that takes non-consumable food waste out of the trash and converts it into energy. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jennifer Weingart reports that the system is expected to reduce the university's food waste by 10% campus-wide.
On the kitchen end of Notre Dame's system, dishwashers and bussers sort out what can be put into the system. It's weighed, and then it's put through what's basically an industrial garbage disposal.
So this is a mixed protein matter. It's fajitas from somebody's fajita bar last night.
That's Susan Soyser. She's part of the team that does logistics for the sustainability initiatives at Notre Dame. The system is in place at the Center for Culinary Excellence, where all the catering work at Notre Dame is done. More recently, two new systems were placed at the North and South dining halls. The system works the same at all three places. Soyson explains.
It just goes through that, and then as we said, it's mixed into this slurry and goes out the pipe. And the really important thing to do is make sure that there is a mixture of food.
The program began after many students called for composting on campus. The question of whether that would work was put to chemical engineering student Matthew Magira, who at the time was an intern at the Notre Dame Office of Sustainability.
My first task was determining if composting was possible at all, and if not, what other solutions there were.
And with the waste Magira was seeing on campus daily, he was motivated to find a solution.
One of the cups in the dining hall, if everybody filled up one of those with waste for every meal. So the scale of food waste is pretty tremendous.
After some research, he found that composting was not the answer.
So we don't have the raw material, we don't use the product, and the labor and logistics costs would be pretty incredible.
The solution? Anaerobic digestion. That slurry that's created in the garbage disposal is turned into three products.
The gas product we can burn for energy. The liquid product we can sell to farmers as fertilizer because it's very rich in nitrogen. And the solid product can be skimmed off and used as cattle bedding.
The digesters are not at Notre Dame. They're 30 miles south at Homestead Dairy in Plymouth.
The slurry will then be pumped into the digesters.
That's Jill Huyen, the resident educator and calf raiser at Homestead Dairy.
And the digester has a big turbine that will spin, and it's self-generated. So all the electricity that is being produced here is also running itself.
The digesters themselves look like two big green tents. The retention pit where the slurry is dumped fills the air with a pungent mix of rotting food and manure. It's pumped into the digester where it creates the methane that's used much like natural gas to power a set of generators on site. Huyen says they sell the power to NIPSCO. It creates enough power for roughly 1,000 homes in Plymouth. It's not only Notre Dame that provides the slurry for the digesters. It also comes from the farm itself and from other companies that work with the dairy. And the digester feeds other sustainability measures at the farm. The bedding is
repurposed manure solids from the digester and from a screw press.
Huyen says it's pressed, heated, and dried.
So if you smell this, this is the bedding. This is
smell like
I know, exactly.
That bedding is used for the dairy's 4,800 cows.
And then that, in turn, will then be scraped back and we reuse it in the digester.
Homestead Dairy also farms 4,500 acres in corn or soybeans each year, and it has what's currently the biggest robotic dairy operation under one roof in the United States. That's where we ran into Floyd Huyen, the farm's patriarch. He summed up why the digesters matter.
Well, that's good to keep it out of the landfills and get more value out of it.
Jill Huyen says Homestead is glad to have the partnership with Notre Dame, and like the university, the farm continues to up its sustainability game. She says they'd like to have the energy created in the digester power the farm. It's a democracy, she says, so the family will make further sustainability decisions together. At Notre Dame, the digesters are just a part of the university's overall goal to reduce all waste by 67% by 2030. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jennifer Weingart.
And this is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. The fellow who is best known for C-SPAN, Brian Lamb, has stepped aside the TV camera, the microphone, at least on a full-time basis now. He's still on occasionally, but he's stepped away from this full-time job that he had. That goes all the way back to the creation of C-SPAN many years ago. And we have Brian Lamb with us on the phone from the C-SPAN headquarters to talk about it. Brian, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Hi, Chris. Glad to be with you.
Thank you very much for joining us today. If you will, first tell us a little bit about how your involvement in broadcasting and what you did in Washington, D.C. led up to the creation of C-SPAN.
Well, I came here in the United States Navy back in 1966, and born and raised in Lafayette, went to Purdue, spent 4 years in the Navy, and I got started in all this by seeing what was going on inside the Pentagon. And I was not an important part of the Pentagon. I was a gopher, but I was a lieutenant junior grade, and that's how I got started in this town.
And what made you think that that C-SPAN would be something important? I know you've had a lot of support over the years, I guess, taking your idea of getting public affairs on television, and in particular on cable TV, because I know that's how you created C-SPAN, is by your cooperation with all of the cable systems around the country.
I actually didn't think it was going to be necessarily important. I thought it was going to be an interesting possibility to be an alternative for everything else that was on television news. There was no real public affairs. Public television dabbled in it, but on a national basis, they found that in order to keep the money coming in, they had to get away from a lot of that. They weren't anxious to do a lot of hearings. When I started with it, we had no idea where it would go, and it all started because technology changed. The satellite was launched back in 1975 for cable, and they started, HBO was the first one, they started using the satellite, and it just seemed like something that I could suggest to the industry, didn't have any idea if they'd take it, and they, you know, it wasn't going to cost much, and a couple of really good guys thought that it would be a good civics opportunity, and that's how it started.
How difficult was it to get the chance to see sessions of Congress, either the House and the Senate or both of them, on television, and now did you see them basically full-time?
The House had been talking about it for years, but nobody knew it, and they had a little commission set up behind the scenes. And when I first pitched the idea of something to the cable television industry, it wasn't to cover the House gavel to gavel. They first said, a couple guys first said, yeah, we can fund that. That makes sense, and it wasn't going to cost much. But after they went around and talked to people in the cable industry, they started saying, I don't think that's worth it. I don't see where there's a market for that. And, of course, we never intended it to be a for-profit thing. Then all of a sudden, after they said no the first time around, actually a lot of people said no, The House decided to go on television, and I was right in the mix at that point and found out about it before they made the final decision and made the suggestion that maybe if they decided to put the House on television that the cable people could carry it to the home, and that's how it started. It all just went very fast back in 1977 in October. When it was voted in.
Now, how long did it take to get the Senate on cable as well, too?
They were so dead set against the idea, and the old-timers didn't want anything to do with transparency and opening it up. It took till June 2nd of 1986 to go on television.
Wow, more than a decade later, then, it sounds like.
Yeah,
yes. Sure. What, were they just afraid that they didn't want to see people with their shirt tails out or chewing gum or something or smoking on camera?
I don't really know. I think it's a case of where people like the power they have in these institutions, and bringing something in from the outside called television made them nervous. It's the same thing going on right now with the Supreme Court. They're dead set against the idea of going on television, and it'll be a while. And they don't have the same concerns that members of the House and Senate have, which is basically getting voters to vote for them. So it's an interesting thing to watch the whole idea of opening the process up. There are a lot of people that talk about it, but very few people in positions of power that really want to do it.
Now, being with the C-SPAN concept from the very beginning, and of course, going first with members of the House and then the Senate, of course, and other activities of government in Washington, D.C., you started doing conversations about books, talking to authors and the like. What are some of the things that you remember the most? That, in fact, it's only been just a few years ago that you had quit doing the book reviews and the like here. What do you remember most about talking with the authors?
Well, I started in 1988 with an interview with a guy named Neil Sheehan, who wrote a book, The Bright Shining Lie, which was all about Vietnam, and it was very much anticipated. It took him 16 years to write it. I just got intrigued by the idea after Vietnam, which was such a miserable experience for this country, that Neil Sheehan might be able to shed some really interesting light on why we got in there and what happened. And so I sat down with him for 2.5 hours. We created 5 programs, stripped them across the 8 o'clock hour. And after that, it seemed like what a great, interesting possibility to talk to authors about their hardback nonfiction books. That's what started Book Notes in 1989. I did it for 16 years and decided that, and I had my own rules, that I had to read the book and it had to be a hardback and it had to be nonfiction and it could only be an author on the show once. And I got to the end of 16 years and said, this is taking too much of my time. So I just changed the name, called it Q&A, kept doing it and until right now, and still did a lot of books. So I just stumbled into the whole thing about books, and it's been very important to us.
Now let's go from Book Notes to your book that you have out there available that you've written not long ago and is available to look at here about the presidents. Give us an idea first about how you came up with the concept and a little bit about the book.
Actually, when we started Book Notes, we came up with the concept of doing a book very long time ago, over 20 years ago, by taking the author's comments and their narrative and taking my questions out and creating 10-page chapters that reflect what they said in the interviews. And we've done 9 of those books, and this latest book is called The Presidents, and it's 44 chapters. 44 different presidencies. It does not have a chapter. It has a chapter on Donald Trump, but not about whether he was successful or not. It just talks about what the atmospherics were when he got elected. And the idea was to be able to read about something about each president, and then when you're interested, dig deeper on your own. Go get the book, go get other books, and just give yourself a good civics education.
I guess you could say, about Donald Trump, that in a word, that the story about him hasn't yet been written. So I guess you can't put that chapter in anyway, could you?
Not even close to being written. And we don't do these surveys of where the presidents stand until after they're out of office.
We're talking with Brian Lamb, who is a native of Lafayette, a graduate of Purdue University, and is the creator of the concept, and later now what we know as C-SPAN, the cable television networks, more than one network, we should say, that deals with public affairs and a lot of it dealing with official Washington, D.C. And we should say, too, that C-SPAN has an outreach to Indiana still, don't they? They have an operation based in northwest Indiana that kind of helps service C-SPAN in a way, doesn't it?
We have our video archive with 250,000 hours of hearings and everything we've had on the network since 1987, located in West Lafayette, Indiana. It was originally associated with Purdue, but we separated some years ago, and we just kept it in Lafayette, run by a Purdue professor who works for us on a full-time basis, Robert Browning. And anybody in the country, anybody in the world that can access the archive on the internet can watch any program we've done over those last 250,000 hours.
Oh my gosh, 250,000 hours, hard to believe, to be sure.
I know.
Now, keeping you in northwest Indiana, in Lafayette in particular, how did growing up in Lafayette and your experiences in Lafayette and West Lafayette there at Purdue seem to shape your life and in turn your career?
Had tremendous impact. I went to Purdue. I was a hometown guy. My father was from that area. My mother came out of Arkansas. Lafayette was a very open community. They were very interested in people like me getting to do anything they wanted to do and take a chance. And my first boss at WASK, which you worked at for some years was Henry Rosenthal, and Henry was a mentor. And I also worked at the local television station. Fella from Indiana, Dick Shively, was the owner there. And these were very important people to me, including my high school broadcasting teacher. It all came out of that community to give me the chance to do what I've done, which, you know, trust me, I'm very grateful.
Give us some recollections, if you will, about starting out in local broadcasting. We always think of the big city, like in our case, Chicago, or New York, or Los Angeles, or other bigger cities, or smaller cities of that magnitude. What's it like to work in local radio, and what did you happen to remember and kind of bring back some anecdotes about it?
Well, what I've learned since I was in local radio is that national radio is no different. If you're doing what comes naturally, you're trying to pass information on to the public, and it really doesn't feel any different. When I was in Lafayette on that radio station, one day a buddy of mine and I called a guy named Franklin McCormick. He used to do an all-night show on WGN in Chicago. And I remember my question to him was, how does somebody like me, and I think I was 19 at the time, get from Lafayette to having a big-time job like you in Chicago?
Yeah.
And he said, well, if my recommendation is you stay there as long as you can, because what you're learning there is just as significant as what you're going to learn beyond there, and then come to the big city and give that a try later. Lafayette Radio allowed me to interview all kinds of well-known national figures because Purdue would have these entertainers come to campus. One of the first ones I ever interviewed was a man named Nat King Cole, and he was a tremendous personality in those days, and he would entertain at Purdue. He died at age 45. But when he was there, he allowed me to interview him for the local radio station. The Kingston Trio were really a big deal. They came to that area, and I went up to Monticello, Indiana, and sat down and interviewed them. And what I most remember from that interview is that I said after it was over, it was only 15 minutes, I said, let me check the tape. I checked the tape, and it didn't take. And I looked at these three guys, and I said, is there any way we can do this again? Because if I go back to Lafayette without an interview with you, I'm going to get fired. And those guys, Nick Reynolds, Bob Shane, and David Gard, said yes. So I redid the interview, and I went back, and I wasn't a hero, but I certainly wasn't dismissed from the radio station.
Well, at least you got the interview. That's right. It happens like that. Well, those problems happen even today, even in the digital age. And that brings me to my final question to you, Brian, to talk about your views about the changing media landscape, especially here in the Internet era.
I love what's happening. I know there's some glitches. I know there's some concern. But people have never had this kind of freedom in the history of the world. And it's so much fun to watch people create their own podcasts. I just saw a headline somewhere, is Bill Clinton going to create his own podcast? Wouldn't surprise me. It's a lot of fun. It doesn't cost much. Nobody controls what you're going to say. If it doesn't work, so what? And there's never been this opportunity like there is now. And I love what's going on. I don't like some of the nasty stuff that we hear, but we started out hearing the nasties when we started our call-in show in October of 1980. People, when they're anonymous, can say whatever they want to say, and it creates somewhat of this hate atmosphere we have. But I think we've got to have faith that over time this is all going to settle down, and the freedom that people have is extraordinary.
Do you think that maybe with this being the podcast era, that because anybody can do a podcast, you can also say, too, that if you do it right and do it slickly enough, I suppose, for some, that you can make lots of money from it, I suppose?
I guess. It's never been the kind of thing that drove me to make money. And this is a nonprofit company supported by the cable television business, or we wouldn't be here. But, yes, I hear people talking all the time about doing it for money and doing it with advertisers, and it obviously in several cases it works.
Now, Brian, let me ask just a little question now. That is the last question. If you could do something all over again, what would you do?
Well, it's pretty simple. If I had to do over again, I would raise more money in the beginning. It caused us to struggle during the early part of the cable business programming getting bigger and bigger. And because of that, we haven't been treated in some cases as well as we could have been if we were in a little bit better financial condition. Having said that, we're in great financial condition during this period right now, and we're going to need it because cable television is losing subscribers to the young kids that aren't interested in They want their their smartphones, and that's what they're number one interested in. And so it's going to give us a cushion, but that's what I would do differently if I could start over again, but I'm not going to be able to.
Well, Brian Lamb, thank you for spending time with us today. We really appreciate the opportunity to talk with not only, a giant of the telecommunications industry and how you've created C-SPAN and how it's become the great public affairs networks of today, but also, too, that you're an Indiana native and that you've been able to show folks back here in Indiana that you can take a simple idea and turn it into something very successful. Thank you for being with us today, Brian.
Thanks, Chris. I always consider myself a Hoosier, no matter how far I get away from it, and it was a great place to grow up.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, we've had a chance to talk with this fellow before on other projects involving enviroforensics. One project that they finished up in Crown Point, we have Steve Henshaw, who's the CEO of enviroforensics with us. Steve, thanks for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, first, for folks that may not remember our last conversation, tell us what enviroforensic does and how important it is, in particular, to this particular project that you guys have just finished up in Crown Point.
Sure. Thank you so much. Enviroforensics has been in business for well over 20 years, and we are a full-service environmental engineering firm. So we investigate environmentally contaminated sites, and we also then, of course, design and implement the remediation. So we get them through the process, the regulatory process, and get them back on in productive hands to develop and reuse and get back on the tax roll. What's unique about enviroforensics is that we have the ability to go back and find old insurance policies that were really written for normal slip and fall. So normal slip and fall CGL policies, comprehensive general liability policies, to pay for the expensive cost of environmental cleanup and investigation. And that's what really sets us apart from the competition, is that we can go in and find the money to pay for these cleanups, which can routinely be $1.5 million at just a normal dry cleaner.
Tell us in particular with this project, which is used to be known as the Family Pride Laundry. It was located on North Main Street in Crown Point. Many people drive by it even now every day as they're traveling north and south into and out of downtown Crown Point. This business has been closed for a number of years, and I guess it's been up for sale for some time, but it's not had much luck in finding a new owner because of all of its past baggage, so to speak here. Tell us what you folks have managed to clean up out of that facility to be able to reopen it up again and make it redevelopable.
Thank you. Chris, this was a site that was really brought to us through the bank that the previous owner was working with. So in many situations, when a business obtains a loan to buy equipment and operate, they commonly put up the property as an asset and a secured asset. And, of course, in the business of an environmentally contaminated piece of property, the bank may not realize what they were having as their secured asset, because when the business was no longer to perform on the loan, the bank considered foreclosing on the property because they really didn't want to be a property owner of a piece of contaminated property.
Well,
so
yeah. Mm-hmm.
They brought us in, and we were able to find a buyer for the note and then pursue the old insurance policy. So it's taken a little bit of time in that structure of just being able to sort of work out those details. But once we got all that taken care of with the bank and the note was in new hands and we continued to pursue the insurance carrier, we investigated the site, determined the extent of the contamination, and then we brought in a unique process of using thermal remediation, which really heats up the soil and the groundwater, and it drives off the volatile organics that are in the soil and groundwater, because these old dry cleaners use solvents to take greases out of clothing and fabrics, and these solvents are carcinogenic and they are heavier than water and they fall through the water column. Really, just as a normal routine part of the business, these solvents can enter sewers or cracks in the floor through spills. And a little bit goes a long way. And unfortunately, many, many dry cleaners experience this environmental contamination. But in this situation, we brought in and employed a thermal remediation technology that worked with the NIPSCO to bring in a high voltage power line and heated the soil and the groundwater to near boiling. Mm-hmm. And used this, implemented this in about May of last year, and we were able to shut the system down in late August, early September, and we have about 99% removal of the contamination just in that 3-month period of time. So that's
wow.
What really makes this site unique, because these are sites that can go on for 5, 10, 15 years, and then these residual amounts of contamination that are still in there are really still at levels that will require long-term monitoring of maybe 15 more years just to monitor and make sure that the contaminants aren't migrating off-site. But in this situation, we were able to get 99% of the contamination out of the soil and the groundwater in about 120 days.
Now, Steve, I understand in this particular site, what used to be the Family Pride Laundry there on Main Street in Crown Point, it's just, I guess they call this stuff PERC, which is short for percochloroethylene, which is, like you say, it's a solvent. Basically, it was used commonly in dry cleaning. You take your stuff in to get those spots taken out or whatever, when it was still in business, and they'd use that stuff in their machines. So I'm sure that probably what a lot of this was, I imagine, probably were accidental spills of PERC, but somehow or another, it didn't matter. It still got into the groundwater, didn't it?
That's correct. And you know, the older machines didn't have the same, recycling capabilities. So oftentimes the PERC was transferred to a distillation still and, to try to take the old, to boil down the PERC so that, it comes overhead and it's clean again and gets reused. It's just a process of recycling.
Right.
But then you would have these overfills and spills in the boiler system. You would have inadvertent, doors popping open with this solvent. You would have, just small releases, but over time they accumulate into, a large enough problem that the state and the regulatory agency gets concerned about the carcinogenic aspects in the soil and the groundwater.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're talking here whether this place opened up as a dry cleaners and laundry in 1961, I think, if my info is right, and was open until 2012 when the business finally closed up there. And then, of course, that means the site's been unusable, I guess, pretty much since then, until you folks with EnviroForensic managed to help get the process going and get the cleanup started and finished up now, we understand. How do people feel now that they've got all the cleanup down to 99% clean? You can't get much cleaner than that short of just pure soil.
Right. Well, we do have some interested parties now that are knocking on the doors and would like to use that property, and it's been a bit of an eyesore for some time. So we're excited about being able to put that back into productive use.
That's
and,
right.
That's the name of the game here, is to try to get cleanups done quickly, rapidly, and get them back on the tax rolls.
Now, for folks that maybe they're not aware what you folks have done, I know this is not the first project you've worked on in Lake County or in Northwest Indiana. You've worked on a number of them before, and some rather literally environmentally dirty areas too, I understand.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The dry cleaning industry has been something we've been closely involved with, but it's not exclusive to that. So EnviroForensics has been involved with the East Chicago Waterway Canal project, the Gary Airport, the Walton Street Lagoon that used to receive wastewater from the sanitary POTW. So we've been involved in rather large scale projects as well. But the interesting thing is these small dry cleaners cause just as much environmental impact as some of these larger manufacturing sites, and it sort of goes against the grain of what you might think. But these small dry cleaners, these releases of perchloroethylene can be, upwards of $1.5 million, $2 million cleanup. So they really are expensive, and of course, the real problem there is these small mom and pops just have no way of paying for those cleanups. So if not for our ability to go back and find old insurance policies that can pay for these expensive cleanups, these sites would end up being orphan sites that then, the EPA might have to take over and of course, that would be all on the taxpayers to eventually clean those up.
Well, that'd be a tough place to set up, have to do a brownfield project, to be sure, for the EPA right in the middle of town, basically, because that's right smack in a residential and a commercial area, too, of Crown Point. Pretty tough there. Can you fill us in on any other related projects that you and your folks at Enviro Forensics are working on now?
Well, we're embarking on a number of projects in the area. There's some abandoned sites within Hammond, and we're working with the city of Hammond to restore a couple of old abandoned sites there. Probably can't release the names at this point.
Yeah.
But there's still a number of manufacturing sites that we've been asked to come out and take a look at and see if we can use our unique approach of finding those old insurance policies, because we also have a division, an archaeology division, that goes all over the country looking for and finding old insurance policies. So these policies, again, are not written for cleaning up contamination. They were written as normal slip and fall policies, normal CGL policies, but because they didn't have exclusions for pollution, they are able to be used to address environmental contamination, asbestos exposure, and other claims that might come about. So that is, something that we are active in all across the country and certainly in Northwest Indiana.
Well, Steve, thank you very much for bringing us up to date here and certainly giving us some pending closure, we're sure, with no doubt soon to be new owners of the site that used to be so contaminated that it had to close up until you folks with Enviro Forensics were able to get in there and get the cleanup not only done, but also make it available for somebody to be able to take on as a new property someday. Thank you for being with us to talk about it.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate the opportunity.
Steve Henshaw is the CEO of a company called Enviro Forensics. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow, we have a special program. We'll bring you the Portage Mayoral Candidates Forum and debate that was held in Portage last week. And we hope you'll join us.